In 5, 4, 3, 2.
Defying the laws of the universe. Traveling across the globe. Giving up life and liberty. Finding the real people. Finding the truth. This team will stop at nothing to tell your story. Decades in the making. Finding the people behind the ads. Ad Phantom has arrived.
A little over the top?
Yeah, just a little.
Whatever, just roll with it.
All right, here we go.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ad Phantom Show.
Brought to you by AdPhantom.com.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm John.
And we're your openly geeky hosts. Well, I guess we should clarify on that. I mean, it's not like we're walking around with our lightsabers out in public.
Actually, Ryan, I've got my lightsaber in my hand right now.
John, put that away.
I'm the master now.
I'll show you, master. Get over here.
Get over here.
Okay, now that we got that squared away.
Okay, I know, Ryan. I'm the Robin to your Batman. I'm the Starscream to your Megatron. I'm the Rory to your Amy Pond.
Damn straight. Okay, so now where were we? Yes, guests. So our special guests this week, we have 3 video game developers focused on art design.
And after that, we'll hear from the metal band A Cryptic Ending.
It's going to be a great show. Our biggest challenge will definitely be keeping the interviews to a decent time length.
No doubt.
Well, John, it has been a rough week for the world.
Yep.
The stock market is uneasy, a large tech company changes major gears, and even Britney Spears has a song that is number one on the charts again. It's like the freaking Twilight Zone out there.
Ugh, it makes my skin crawl just thinking about it.
I found something a little concerning about a couple people that are right in your area of expertise.
Oh yeah? I think I know who you're talking about.
Yep, Paula Deen and Anthony Bourdain. So, apparently Anthony Bourdain told TV Guide this. The worst, most dangerous person to America is clearly Paula Deen. She revels in unholy connections with evil corporations, and she's proud of the fact that her food is effing bad for you. Plus, her food sucks. I can't believe how incredibly hypocritical this guy is. When half of his show, he's just sitting there downing cocktails. Paula Deen says in response, "Get a life," and explains that her mission, unlike his, is geared towards struggling working families. So she elaborates, "You know, not everybody can afford to pay $58 for prime rib or $650 for a bottle of wine. My friends and I cook for regular families who worry about feeding their kids and paying the bills. It wasn't that long ago that I was struggling to feed my family, too." Honestly, I think this was just a cheap shot by Anthony Bourdain.
Ryan, I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you right off the bat. Though I love Paula Deen and she speaks to this inner Southerner, I think that Anthony Bourdain, even though he does it in a really brash, arrogant, jerky way, makes a good point. She does make affordable kitchen equipment and she tries to get to the root of things, but some of her recipes are a bit intense. I mean, she does have a recipe for deep-fried butterballs.
Yeah, but the point is, you don't have to make that deep-fried butterballs recipe. In fact, one of her episodes, I remember her specifically saying, "Look, y'all, I am your cook, not your nutritionist or your dietitian." And I think that's absolutely right. You have a choice. You don't have to cook something that you think is unhealthy for you. But if you want to try something new that's cheap, you can go with Paula Deen and you're fine.
Yeah, no, I see your point there. I just think that, you know, Anthony Bourdain, he's got a soft place in my heart, and he's always told it like it is. And sometimes he doesn't always do it in the most tactful way. But, you know, he's never going to lie to you.
I just think it's cheap for him to be attacking somebody else in the food industry. I don't think it's a right. And on top of all that, I don't understand what the deal is with everyone painting corporations as being the bad guy. Through these corporations, Paula has worked with thousands of food banks across America, and they have a goal of reaching 20 million people with food. They've currently reached just over 10 million. Why is it that unless you're wearing all your charities on your shoulder, the assumption is that you don't help anyone and you just hoard all your money?
You do make a good point there, Ryan, and I think that feeding America is important, but more important than that, I think teaching America how to feed themselves well and nutritionally is equally as important. My hope is that with Paula Deen coming from a Southern background and Anthony Bourdain coming from a French background, maybe eventually they can come to the dinner table together and share their love for butter.
Well, I hope you're right. She invited him to join her at her Sunday table for dinner. I hope he takes it up and that it ends up being a great publicity thing for both of them.
Hopefully they both film it and it'll make some good TV.
Absolutely. But I do have to disagree on you with something, but I forgot what it was, so I'm not going to go on with it.
Okay. Maybe we can agree on one thing. We both like bacon.
Absolutely. So you got a bacon recipe for us?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure do, Ryan. The bacon recipe I have for you today is an awesome little appetizer. If you're having a little get-together, it's easy to throw together. It's basically Swiss cheese, cream cheese, some chives, a beaten egg, and some ranch dressing mix, and about a half a pack of cooked crumbled bacon, and some puff pastry. You just put the puff pastry in a mini muffin pan. You cut the puff pastry into squares, and you mix all the rest of the ingredients. You put a heaping tablespoon in each. Put them in the oven at 425 until they're golden brown and delicious. Usually takes about 15, 20 minutes, and then you enjoy them. This recipe makes about 5 dozen.
So that's enough for just me, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. It'll definitely feed 2 hungry guys like us for the evening. I stand by these little puff cups, and they're pretty amazing.
They sound delicious.
Puff cups.
I stand by these puff cups.
All right, let me try it again. This is actually one of my favorite recipes when you're throwing a party. It's quick to put together. You probably have all the ingredients in your pantry or refrigerator right now, and I promise it doesn't disappoint.
It really sounds great. All right, well, I got to apologize. We've been a little behind on getting John's recipes on the site, but they should be up by now, and you can check them out right under the show section of adphantom.com.
That's right. In addition to those recipes, we're going to have a submission section so that you can send me your favorite bacon recipes. If I like them, I'll make them, and I'll even put them on the show. We might have some contests in the future, maybe some sweepstakes. It's up to you. So really, send us what you think.
All right, John, I can't wait any longer. Let's get to our special guest for the video game development industry.
Absolutely. And after that, we've got the metal band, A Cryptic Ending.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Was that too much?
No.
This has been an exciting time here at AdPhantom.
As you know, we're doing our best to bring down the impersonal nature of the internet when it comes to buyer and seller. And we work hard to find small businesses, large corporations, entrepreneurs with a great idea, and especially artists trying to get out to the public.
Just recently, we've hit some great milestones.
Absolutely, John. This idea of finding the real people behind the ads has caught the attention of some of the bigger, well-known groups. We're proud to announce that AdPhantom has now partnered with Apple, Barnes & Noble, Groupon, Logitech, Newegg, just to name a few.
That's right, and through these partnerships, we're able to offer you weekly specials and even some daily deals through our website that gives you the access to these deals that you may not find elsewhere.
Not only do we offer great deals, but by purchasing through us, you help support AdPhantom so that we can continue to bring you more great content.
Are you in a band looking to promote your music? Are you a small business owner trying to reach a larger market? We can help.
In tackling the impersonal nature of the interwebs, we're looking to promote the real people.
To contact us, you just need to visit our website and click the link appropriately entitled Contact Us. It's at the top right of the page.
AdPhantom.com, finding the people behind the ads. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. In this segment, we're excited to talk with 3 professional video game developers and discuss the ins and outs of video game art. John, why don't you introduce our guests for us?
Absolutely, Ryan. First, we have Andy Foltz. This dapper man has a BFA in graphic design from Appalachian State. He's working at Red Storm now on Ghost Recon Future Soldier. In his spare time, he loves to create art and music, and he currently has a painting in the Super I Am 8-Bit show in Los Angeles, which I think is super awesome.
Oh, nice.
Next, we have Kevin Altman. Along with being an animal lover, he went to the School of Communication Arts for a degree in digital animation. He's currently working at EA Games. In his free time, he loves to create in many different mediums, being the big spoon, eating food, and grabbing some TV movies whenever possible. Last but certainly not least, we have Juan Colado, and he has a BFA in interactive design and game development. He's in the industry for about 4 years now, working at Virtual Hero, Inc. In his free time, he enjoys billiards, breakdancing, custom map building, and breaking the stereotype, all three of these men are in relationships with women.
Nearly every preteen and teenage boy nowadays would love to develop video games. What made you guys decide to take the extra step and actually make a career out of it? Kevin, we'll start with you.
Well, I guess when I was a little kid, you know, I kind of got the idea in my head that I wanted to make video games. And, you know, when I went through school, you know, I always had that in my mind. That's where I was going. And after high school, you know, I got the first thing that I could, and I started making art. And I did that for a while. And I kept saying to everyone I knew, you know, I don't care how I get there, but I'm going to make video games. And one day, you know, I just got that call that said, hey, you want to come work for EA Games? Sure, I'm there. So, you know, that's how I got there.
Juan, go ahead.
Well, same thing as all kinds of preteen boys right now. It's that I really liked to play video games when I was younger, and I had a little bit of a talent for art, so I started pursuing that. And I ended up going to a, oddly enough, fashion school for a degree in fine arts. And when I realized about 2 days into that I was never going to make any money with that, I decided I really wanted to pursue my career in game development. And jump schools from there to Savannah College of Art and Design and started working my butt off down there. Once I got out, after 8 months of working at Starbucks, got my first job at the Serious Games company that I'm at now, doing what I love.
Andy, how about you?
For me, it was something I kind of fell into a little bit. Art was always a passion of mine, so I grew up with art and did a lot of drawing and a lot of art classes going through, you know, middle school and high school and into college. But games were something that I liked and enjoyed, but I was never good at them, and I never had my own console system until, you know, very late. So games weren't a primary focus, and I never imagined that I would have an opportunity to work in games in this area. And so because of that kind of self-defeating, you know, attitude with that, you know, it was never a drive or a passion or a goal until I got out of college and I saw an ad on one of the bulletin boards at the School of Communication Arts when I went there for a presentation about 3D Studio Max. And I saw the ad, and it was for random games, and they were hiring. So I said, hey, yeah, I'll try this out, because at the time I was working at a print shop, and I was just, you know, outputting people's files to the film, you know, thing for offset printing, and it was pretty boring. So I sent in my resume to the random games people, and I kind of forgot about it because, again, I didn't really have any hope. And so they contacted me and liked my portfolio, and it's been, you know, kind of fun times ever since.
Andy, do you find that since you didn't grow up with a game background that you're more into games now than you were then?
Well, it's not that I grew up without a games background. I mean, I went to the arcades, you know, any chance I could, but I never had a lot of quarters. And for me, it was more visual stimulation than it was the actual gameplay. I loved watching and loved looking at the sprites and you know, the glowing things, and I loved hearing the sounds and all of that stuff. And so even if I couldn't play or if I couldn't play well, I would watch and, you know, enjoy it. And then later on, my brother had like a Genesis, and that was kind of the start of things. And even still, well, actually, before that, we had an Atari 800, you know, personal computer, and we played a lot of games on that. It was never a primary hobby. It was never, you know, a focus. It was something I liked. It's something that I did and had fun with, but it wasn't, you know, the main thing. And so now I have both a PS3 and an Xbox, and I have a Wii, and I have an old Dreamcast laying around somewhere and an old Xbox One. So I have a lot of systems, but I don't play them that often. I play games more to look at them, actually, than to actually play them.
Being artists, what challenges do you face in drumming up creative genius when you're working on a deadline? Juan, why don't we start with you?
the challenges I end up facing a lot of times are, since I work in serious games, which is a little bit of a different flow than the regular game development, we have to do things typically as close to realism as possible. So you end up having a lot of issues trying to make things look exactly how they do in the real world, but then trying to add creativity to that scene. So for me, since I work in level design, it's all about placement and kind of telling a story through placement and setting up your assets and your art in a way that will guide the player to look at certain areas or something along those lines.
I want to add on that. So I think in that instance, it's more of like a psychological problem or a psychological creative problem that you're trying to solve instead of a visual problem. And I think that's something that we run into a lot is that, you know, although we're not always solving straight art creative problems, right, everything that we do has to be solved creatively.
Andy, would you agree with him?
Yes. Well, I'm just thinking about the processes that I've been through at different times. And for me, it's very much a thing where I have to put it together and get like a wireframe or prototype working first to get a feel for the real problems. And a lot of this maybe has to do with the focus that I have in the games, and that's user interface art. That has a lot of practical concerns. It's not like I'm doing creature designs or concepts for environments or anything like that, where it's more of an open kind of creative thing. With user interface design, it's more very practical and user focused, and you want to kind of streamline the experience while still giving users a kind of entertaining experience, because it is a game. It's not productivity software. So for us, we try to kind of build up prototypes and wireframes and get a feel of what kind of problems, and then once we get that working, then we go back, you know, and refine and go through the creative process more with the visuals and think about how we want to polish it and how we want to make it better. And then, you know, the creativity is almost like an accident of the process of building things, because we build it and people get eyes on it and then they say, hey, what if we did this? And so the ideas come from all over the place. And at least in my experience, it's been my job to kind of wrangle in all the different ideas from all over the place and kind of tie them together as best as possible and to look for the best ideas and figure out how to integrate them.
To make sure that I'm correct here, both Kevin and Andy, you guys work on the UI, right? Or the user interface for all our non-geeky folks out there.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's right.
In my case, it's a little different. I do user interface stuff, but I have an interactive background. So I actually work more with the game designers and the producers than a UI artist typically would. You know, I make decisions that actually affect gameplay.
Okay. Well, so how do you create a UI that is still familiar to the player, but is not, you know, just becoming a clone of another setup?
So that's actually a really good question. There's a lot of discussion on this topic, and one of the ways to look at it is that, you know, no creative idea is original. And there's no way around that. Nothing is original. It's already been done before. But the thing is, taking ideas that already exist and making them your own, that's the key. We spend a lot of time looking at other things and using those as our inspiration so that we can build on them. And there's really good techniques. Like, for example, I use my driving time to think about things. So on my commute to and from work, I kind of just sit in my car and think about the things that I worked on all day. You know, during the day, I kind of just make stuff and blah, 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 blah. I listen to people's input. I don't really do anything, really. You know, I'm just pushing pixels around. But when I get in the car and I drive, and, you know, for other people, maybe it's sitting and listening to music, maybe it's doing whatever. But for me, it's when I drive. And when I drive, I kind of can reflect on everything that went on through the day. And I can take all the input and the feedback, all the things that I saw, all the things that I did, and I can kind of transform them in my head so that when I come back the next day, I've got a plan and a strategy to make that thing my own and make it something unique.
John, please don't tell us where you get most of your thinking from on Ad Phantom. Please don't even ever think about sharing that with me. Same question.
Everyone knows that I do my best thinking on the toilet. That's common knowledge, guys. I think most scientific discoveries happen either in the shower or on the toilet.
Is it a specific toilet, or is it just any toilet?
It depends. It has to be it can't be too low. Otherwise, you know, but if it's too high, then, you know, you got the feet problem. So, you know, it's a Goldilocks problem, I know. But
oh dear. All right, reeling it back in. Andy, Would you agree with the UI comments? Do you face the same challenges of not cloning it and trying to come up with something new based on something that the player has to be familiar with?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's definitely a kind of balancing act, but there's a great value in respecting the conventions that users expect, because it's going to reduce the learning curve. It's going to speed up, you know, the time that players will need to get familiar with the game and start having fun. And so you have to do a lot of research, and you have to respect the conventions of previous games and successful titles. But at the same time, you want to give people something new that's exciting, but also something that's unique and something that can help your brand stand out and be recognizable in the marketplace. So that's definitely the challenge.
Common interactive practice is just that. It's like you definitely want to take things that people are familiar with, so that Andy had said that, you know, it reduces that learning curve. You want to make people feel just comfortable enough so that you can confuse them, basically.
Right. It's like when you switch from playing like Call of Duty to, say, Gears of War, where the controls are almost the same, but just different enough that you find yourself like dropping mines when you're trying to shoot something, or change weapons. Is that one of those kind of techniques, or would you?
Well, I'm not sure that I see a value in that where people are doing accidental actions, because that just leads to frustration. There's certainly design constraints that require you to do some different things, and sometimes that's just what you have to do.
Do you ever find it upsetting when you put a lot of work into a UI only to have a player use a custom mod on top of it?
I've never really had that experience. I worked on a few older PC games back in the late 90s, but since then it's been console games, and so people don't really mod those the way they do with a lot of PC games. To answer the question, I mean, if it would happen, that experience is really no different than having all of your work changed and radically altered by design requirements or management requirements or brand management, because that's very much part of the whole process of building the UI. It's constant reworking.
So Juan, in your area of expertise, do you ever feel like you have to be reeled in, so to speak, when it comes to your creative flow and designs?
Quite often, actually, I end up going on tangents. It's kind of like if I'm left to my own devices, I end up making things that are probably going to end up being out of scope. I've either successfully proven things through prototyping. Well, what I'm saying here is that when I get into a project, there will be some times that we'll have a certain design set up for certain interactions or certain level flows or certain areas or something like that. And I'll decide that that's probably not the best way. And instead of just trying to talk it out, I'll give some type of example in there. And that can sometimes be out of scope in terms of the project, or it could be sometimes out of the general vision of the actual game designer in there. Typically, I regard my job as the hand of the game designer, where everything that they want in the game is going to have to go through me to actually be seen by the player. Everything that you do within an editor ends up being the first thing that the player sees or the first thing the player can interact with. So I end up having to get reeled back when I start tweaking features in some ways or adding things that can get the team really excited in some cases. But at the same time, the producers will be like, whoa, what are you doing here? That's adding like 3 more weeks of work if we want to polish that to the same level as everything else.
Right.
I'm like, no, but I swear I can do it.
What kind of creative or artistic direction or boundaries are you guys given when you're working on a project?
It's hard to answer without being very general, but for us, we have kind of brand requirements and the kind of style and atmosphere that are part of being a Tom Clancy game. And beyond that, we have platform requirements, such as the frame buffer or the screen resolution of whatever target platform we're developing for. And also some other things that are related to that, like, you know, what kind of controller graphics are we going to show on the screen, because it's got to match either the Xbox or the PlayStation or, you know, whatever platform we're doing. So those are the base, you know, requirements. Beyond that, it comes from art directors and the feedback that we get from our peers and the managers.
Kevin, what about you?
You know, for me, it actually varies. I tend to do a lot of different things, with my main focus being in the interactive stuff. On that stuff, I come from advertising. I was an art director for years. I kind of am left to my own devices, and nobody really bugs me about stuff. But the one thing that I do run into a lot is line look. And line look is where if my artwork isn't matching artwork that is in the physical game, I've got to change mine, or the other artists have to change theirs. So it's very important that all of the art consistently looks like they're in the same universe. Now, on the other stuff, when I'm doing character concepts or anything else, I'm given pretty strong art direction. It's more along the lines of, this is the type of genre we're going for. This is the type of, you know, demographic. And go find examples. So I go out, I find examples, I bring back examples. They take a look at my examples, and then we go over them, and then we talk about what's good, what's bad, what fits, what doesn't, and how we merge them together. And then with that merging, we try to find something that actually is our style, and then we kind of just do a back and forth kind of system where one artist likes this, one artist doesn't like that, and, you know, we end up hopefully ending in the same place.
Juan, because you do the serious games, do you find those the kind of the consistency of the art is a big of a deal, or how would you answer that question?
Kind of pairs down to who is trying to direct me at that point. Let's see. I have worked under, at this point, 3 different art directors. All of them had different styles. And I've worked for 20 different clients on like 20, 30 projects or so. And it all depends on what the goal of the project is. Like if it's a simulation, like for instance, we've done simulations on, let's see, there's a simulation for a obstetrical hemorrhaging game where we had to make a labor delivery room. I'm not lying to you.
I want more details. How does the research for that go? Do you watch a lot of Discovery Channel? How does that work?
I'm not the character artist, so I'm happy with what I had. There, it was very strict because we had a certain client and we had a specific room layout that we had to go for, and everything was set up in a certain way. We've done other actual serious games that were more freeform in their environments. The client's consideration for their consideration for aesthetic and the art director's consideration for aesthetic were kind of reeling me back in that situation. And then there are some projects where I've pretty much vetted myself and they tell me to do what I think is going to look the best in some cases. Because we're a fairly small team, so we have to manage ourselves a lot of times. So when it's a smaller project and a smaller budget, there's only so much room for outside direction. So you have to kind of set up your own theme and what your goals are in terms of, you know, look and feel of a project. And then sometimes, honestly, there are clients out there that don't know what they want. And they will ask you to revise it 4 times before they go back to the original idea. Because they really don't know what they want.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. It depends on what kind of game development you're doing, right? Because if you're doing client-driven game development, or you're doing AAA title, 2-year deadline kind of game, they're completely different types of art direction. In the client-driven work, everybody's an art director. Everybody has an opinion, and everybody gets a say. And that's really, really hard to deal with. It comes down to, when you have that kind of direction, you really have to lean on the people that you work with directly so that you guys can ally and make decisions together and come up with good plans to go back to the client with, or go back to your boss or your manager, which you still have to do that in the big AAA stuff. But fortunately, with those titles, it's a lot more structured and you get much better art direction from, you know, a team of art directors or an art director, or, you know, people that basically say you don't have a say.
When something big happens here at Ad Phantom, like partnering with Logitech, Newegg, and Apple, yeah, that was totally an AdPhantom.com plug. It's so hard for me not to spill the beans too early. Being gamers yourselves, we know that you can get excited about the projects you're working on. So how do you keep all that excitement hidden for the duration of the production? Juan, we'll start with you.
It's pretty easy to do it for some of my projects because some of my projects require military security clearance. And that's an entire group of people that I don't want to aggravate.
Is that the hemorrhaging? The hemorrhaging?
No, not that. some other projects, they may not be so glamorous like the obstetrical hemorrhaging. And some of the projects are actually like Moonbase Alpha, which was a free-to-play Steam game that we created about 8 months ago, or we released, rather. And we had to keep it tight-lipped pretty much the entire time. But you have the people you work with, and you have sometimes beta testers, and you have typically friends and family that you can kind of dance around what you're working with. You know, you don't. It's not like breaking the NDA, so to speak, but you can theorize in some ways.
Andy, same question for you.
Well, yeah, as was mentioned, there's, you know, fear for your life. There's, there's the fear for losing your job. You know, those sort of things are great motivators. But yeah, there's definitely a wave of excitement at times where you want to talk about it. But at the same time, you know, with some practice, you develop some professionalism. And like I said, there are other motivators. But also after that, there's a time like when you're working on a project for years and years where you don't have the same kind of fresh eyes that the consumer is going to have. And maybe, you know, for you, it's your day to day, you're something that you see every day. And I think sometimes we can lose sight of the kind of impact that what we're working on is going to have on the consumers. And so I think that's another side of keeping this in, is that, you know, after a while you think, well, you know, I see this every day. It's just what I see every day. You know, it becomes a part of a routine, really. But then, you know, when you finally get to release something like at E3, you know, you think, oh, wow, you know, people are really excited about this. This is cool.
Kevin, how about you? How do you keep things under wraps?
It's kind of the same thing. He made a really good point where you get to a level of professionalism. You get used to seeing the same thing all the time. It gets pretty easy as a whole to not talk about the project, but there are challenges, and some of the challenges are more in your day-to-day tasks. Like if you're working on one particular thing, you get really excited about that one thing you're working on and you want to talk about just that one thing. That's probably the most challenging part. And really what you do about it is you just go, man, I'm working on this really cool thing. I can't wait to tell you about it.
Andy, this one's for you. With Red Storm being a huge focus on Tom Clancy games, what we want to know is how hands-on is he actually in the video game creation process?
I don't know if I'm allowed to answer that. I don't think I can answer it.
Fair enough. Could you answer, is Tom Clancy at all influential? Has he ever showed up to meetings and things like that?
Have you ever met him there? Can we ask that? Have you met Tom Clancy?
I think that's a fair question, and I have never met him.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Well, you other guys have got a couple of projects that I know that you can't talk about, or the military will come after you and blow up your house and all of that. But have you ever met anyone famous, kind of like a Tom Clancy, that's working on the production?
I try to be pretty active in the convention circuit. And, you know, the reality is once you get into the industry, you start meeting people and you find out very quickly that people are people and the famous thing kind of wears away. So, yeah, sure. I've met a few famous people and they're actually really, really great people.
Can you share with us some of those people?
I met Cliffy B at a bar once.
Was that where the art meeting was being held?
I won't say names of who I've met, but I've met some pretty reputable game designers and producers in the industry.
Okay. Right on. Juan, how about you?
Let's see.
Did you meet RuPaul? twice?
Oh. Yeah, just twice.
How was Shim?
let's see. One of my art directors was Takeyoshi Sato, who was the art director for Silent Hills 1 and 2, and the principal guy behind setting up the mood and feel of both of those games. So that was more of a, I guess, geeky level of appreciation that I had for him, because I was like, oh my god, I love those games when I first played them.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's got to be cool to work with your idols. To change gears a little bit, I want to know a little bit about what it's like during crunch time at the end of a project. Andy?
I've been fairly lucky in that, especially at Red Storm, the managers and the people making schedules are very reasonable and very respectful of family and personal time. We have been through crunch times, but they haven't been extreme, at least as from what I hear, you know, from other people in the industry. But, you know, you get to, you know, 12-hour days or whatever, and you kind of get to the point where by the end of the day, you're getting a little silly, and maybe you're not quite as productive as, you know, you'd like to be. And that's just, you know, the kind of cost of getting things done for a deadline.
Kevin, how about you?
I've been really fortunate. Our studio was kind of founded on the idea of no crunch. So we use very strict professional schedules where we're there from 9 to 6, 5 days a week. And we use a different type of development process, which kind of allows us to be more flexible. The few times that we hit crunch, you know, it's like you said, you have your 12-hour days and they get pretty rough and you get pretty worn out. But at the end of it, we kind of get a big break. You know, we found out that in crunch time, you're actually less productive over time if you were instead to just work through the whole time. So for me, I've been extremely lucky in that sense that I've only had to hit crunch, you know, a total of like 2 months in my career.
And Juan?
We work on basically a project-based system where we might have a project for a year, we might have a project for 6 months, we might have a project that is only a month's worth of time to finish, like from start to finish pretty much. And depending on the project, you might have no crunch for quite a long time, and you might have mandatory crunch, and you might be kind of self-imposing just to go that extra mile. But I've had only a few times where I've had really, really long days, and they were for the shorter period, I guess, projects. In longer games, they would be more of like sprints or, you know, just quick milestones they need to get to. I've had the luxury of not having to crunch for, you know, 3 or 4 months straight, but it's definitely really good to not have it all the time because it can wear on you, especially after like a few weeks.
I think for all the aspiring game designers or developers or artists or whatever that are listening to this, the industry is kind of like getting away from the crunch. You know, the industry was kind of founded in this idea of doing crunch and playing the whole time before, and we're actually turning into quite a professional industry. If you're going to crunch, do it before you get into the industry and work really hard so that when you get there, it'll be a breeze. You'll have no idea how easy it is.
There are two ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, you have like the 3 or 4 month death marches, and thank goodness I haven't been a part of that. But on the opposite end, when you have shorter crunches that are right up to a deadline, and when you're working with a tight team, and when you're working on something that's really awesome, a shorter crunch like that can be a great team building experience, especially when you're finished and you're really satisfied and proud of what you've accomplished. You know, that's actually a very positive experience.
Yeah, it definitely is. I had one personally where it was me and a developer ended up staying till 2 in the morning, 2 or 3 nights in a row, because we were so excited about the thing that we were working on. It was hard to get away from the work.
You get closer to people that way, and you become good friends with your team. I mean, eventually, you know, the death marches can be really bad for morale, but you know, the 2 weeks or so of crunch when you're working together to try to get to something and everybody's really passionate about it, and then that really does make a product better in a lot of ways, because if you don't have any negative feelings in your team while they're working really hard, it actually feeds everybody else to work a little bit better, or at least foster a better atmosphere for something that can be trying at times.
Yeah, I think when the crunch is fueled by your peers and not by your managers, that self-imposed crunch, your coworkers actually see you as someone that's willing to work as hard as they are, and you gain respect for each other very quickly, and you gain this ability to lean on each other.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys have had some great experiences, but on the other end of the spectrum, there was a recent report where a big-name game studio, who we will not name, was accused of unfair work practices, such as 100-hour work weeks, among other things that we won't talk about. Have you guys heard or experienced of any conditions in the game industry?
I haven't. I haven't had anything that extreme.
Yeah, I don't have any direct experience, just, you know, the kinds of things, like you said, the things you hear about, or, you know, rumors and stuff like that.
Yeah, I haven't had anything ridiculous.
There have been stories about that kind of stuff, but I think when you're trying to do an indie project or something, you're more likely to do those kinds of things than when you're at a big company, mainly because you're not constrained by all the laws and regulations that big companies have, and it's actually kind of cool to be in that experience when you're first starting out. Like I said, crunch before you get here, because those are some of the most memorable times that you'll ever have in this industry.
HP has just announced that they're pulling out of the personal computer market. They said it's because the market is dying. Now, we've all seen it. I'm sure you guys have seen it, that the simpler handheld games are on the rise. How do you guys feel about that? Andy?
I feel like Apple and its iOS devices have found a way to market and sell a computing device that fits the needs and desires of the kind of casual mass market. And there's a hell of a lot more money in that than the kind of niche stuff that, like the enthusiast PC gamer, that's kind of a niche market that I don't think there's as much money in. And so I think I understand why a company like HP would pull out of some things like that. It's a similar thing with games. I think you see a lot of these mobile games and a lot of these casual games are really cashing in and getting a huge, you know, kind of a market dominance sort of thing. They're tapping into the demographics where there's, you know, millions and, you know, millions of people versus the kind of hardcore gaming thing, which, you know, is definitely a smaller audience. I mean, your mom isn't going to play, you know, Gears of War 3, right? But she is going to play Angry Birds, and she's going to buy it, and, you know. And
for sure.
It's not untapped anymore, but at one point there's a huge untapped demographic that I think the bigger companies were a little bit slow to catch up on that.
This is actually something I'm extremely interested in. I follow it very closely. The mobile or the casual, handheld, whatever you want to say, market is actually really, really interesting. And it's been interesting for the past 2 or 3 years, really. It started out as like a casual thing. And the thing that we're noticing and we're seeing trending as we go forward is that we're training people that don't know how to game, how to game. It's a very, very, very low barrier for entry. And as you watch the games come out, they get more and more complicated. Now, I'm not saying that Gears of War is going to be on, you know, your iPhone next week, but what I mean is gamers are starting to casual game, and your casual gamers that weren't gamers are starting to casual game, and we've got the two different demographics coming together playing the same games, and they're getting harder. They're getting, well, I won't say harder, they're getting more advanced.
Much more complexity is being added to it, and there's a lot to be said with, like, Epic has thrown so much development towards their iOS Unreal Development Kit. It's going to be benefiting. A lot of people are working with that tool, and there's going to be a lot of really interesting games and concepts coming out using, you know, 3D graphics that are not too far off. I mean, there's still a decent difference between a console and an iPad game or an iPad 2 game, but that gap is getting closer and closer.
A few months back, saw Juan at a convention that we saw a talk on this same kind of thing, which is it's not really the handheld game industry that's changing. A lot of people think that the casual games and the iPhones are taking over, and that, you know, they're playing a big part and they're monetizing very well, but there's something much bigger at hand, and it's not just that. The thing that's happening is all of the games industry is evolving. Your go to the store and buy a game on the shelf is going away. And the freemium stuff is what's coming in. It's where you get a game for free or at a very low cost, and you buy content to get what you want. That industry is actually growing exponentially, and it's actually proving to build better games. And that's probably our biggest challenge as game designers right now, is that we're having to relearn how to make games, because that old method is only really going to stand on its platform for the AAA titles that have really long, really, really long deadlines and really big budget. For everybody else, we've got to come up with new ways to innovate and new ways to monetize, because it's just not there anymore.
For someone seriously considering getting into the game development career path, where would you tell them to start, and what path would you recommend they follow to be successful? Andy, we'll start with you.
It really depends on what kind of thing you want to do in the games industry. I can really only speak from my own experience in the art, you know, department side of game development. And from my experience, you need to have the basic skills, but you can kind of teach yourself that. You can watch tutorials on YouTube of how to use Photoshop or whatever. But beyond that, you really need to develop a sense of aesthetics, and you need to know what looks good. And that requires a lot of experience and a lot of kind of study of the competition and current trends, but also a little bit of, you know, the history of what's happened before, even including some art history kind of stuff. It's helpful to understand those basic principles of composition and design and color. That's not something that's easily taught with a lot of trial and error and a lot of experience looking at things. But beyond that, once you get the basic skills and basic sense of aesthetics to know what looks good, I think you need to be as aggressive as possible in working on any kind of mod or any kind of casual game or any kind of, you know, flash game or web game that you can find the opportunity for. Any kind of experience where you're, you know, actually doing real kind of game stuff, even if it's, you know, web-based, is going to, you know, translate to some degree towards, you know, larger, more professional games. And having that experience and being able to show a prospective employer what you've done and that you can actually do, you know, this task is very important.
All right, Juan?
I think that game curriculums at schools are getting better. I know Kevin will disagree with me on this, but I think that going to school is really good, but not just for learning or anything. It's more about the idea of surrounding yourself with people that all have the same type of goal as you and then trying to be better than them. It's plain and simple. It's a bloodthirsty hiring process out there that it's pretty tough to get in, to break into. And I mean, I've taught a couple of cooperative educational classes at a local community college around here in partnership with my job. I've seen the difference in the kids, and there's the kids that are like, oh, I like games. I guess I'll just go into game development. That'll be easy. They watch that Westwood commercial, and apparently they saw that, hey, you can actually, you know, design video games with a controller because that's how it is. And then I saw the other kids that were doing really well in the class, but they were upset with themselves because they weren't at the same level as someone in the industry. If you're either surrounding yourself with more people that are thinking that I have to be at this standard and you're basically competing with them in almost a friendly way or maybe even an actual competitive way, you're going to better yourself and you're going to get ideas from them and they're going to get ideas from you. And that's the one thing that I learned when I went to Savannah College of Art and Design was that, you know, despite the exorbitant amount of student loans I have right now, is that I have about 10 solid connections of guys in the industry that are really talented because we all pushed each other to get to a higher level. Those connections are pretty much worth the loans.
Kevin, what are your thoughts?
Juan says that I'm going to disagree with him. I don't really disagree with him. My opinion is that if you think that you're going to go to school and you're going to get a door opened to your dream job, you're wrong. You're wrong. And the reality is it is so competitive and it takes so much hard work that you have to prepare yourself for that work. School only really sets you up for basic skills, like Andy had said, which are really important. I agree with him 100%. I think good founding skills, learn graphic design. If you're trying to be an artist, get your really, really try to understand graphic design. Try to understand
color theory.
Composition. If you're trying to go into UI, try to understand information design. All those things kind of set you up for anything in the art field. So if you go into, you know, you decide you want to be a character artist, well, you now understand composition and color theory that you learned from graphic design that you couldn't be as good if you didn't have that. And outside of just the education part, if you can't get into games immediately, go into advertising. Go into something really, really stressful and really, really hard, like advertising, that has extremely short deadlines and extremely small budgets and
crazy attrition rates.
Yeah, it really sets you up for, you know, having that aggressive attitude that you need. And that hands down is the most important thing. When you go in, I also disagree with Juan, is that don't look at your peers and try to be better than them. Look at the people that are the best and try to be better than those people, because that's really who you're competing with. You're not competing with the people at school. You're going to be competing with the industry professional. That's who you want to be. So if you can do that and you can work hard and you can, you know, really, really commit, you'll make it. If you can't do those things, then it's going to be really difficult.
That's some great advice from all of you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but I want to thank you guys so much, Kevin, Andy, and Juan, for joining us today. We really appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
We enjoyed your insight and look forward to checking out all of your new projects as they get released. Remember to check them out at adphantom.com. Up next, we're talking with the metalcore band A Cryptic Ending. We'll be right back after this short break. Hey, John, you're in school, right?
Yep.
Did you have to buy textbooks this year?
I sure did. $400 worth, and I only bought 3 books so far.
Ouch. Well, I've got some good news for you, and I hope it's not too late.
Awesome. What's up?
AdPhantom just paired up with Barnes & Noble, and now we're able to offer some great online deals like up to 90% off used textbooks or up to 30% off and free shipping on new textbooks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, even get up to 60% off of downloadable e-textbooks.
Right on.
There are even more back-to-school deals that you can find by visiting adphantom.com.
I imagine I can just go to the homepage and search for Barnes or Noble at the top of the search bar, right?
That's absolutely right.
I'm definitely going to check that out for the rest of my books. AdPhantom.com. Finding the people behind the ads.
Welcome Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our last segment of the show. Joining us as our special musical guest is the metalcore band A Cryptic Ending from Washington-Idaho border. Originally formed in 2003, this band has gone through many changes to find its musical identity and is quite pleased with the result. Ranked number 2 locally in the metal category, number 1 nationally in the screamo genre, and 12th overall in the Battle of the Bands, they currently have out an EP with 4 great tracks. They're constantly playing live shows all over Washington and Idaho while maintaining their competitive edge in the Battle of the Bands. With Dustin on vocals, Mike on drums, Ryan on guitar, and Sean on bass, ladies and gentlemen, A Cryptic Ending. Woo! All right, thanks for joining us, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming. All right, so you guys have been around since 2003, and you guys have quite the history of the change. Mike, what I want to know is, with all these band member changes, what are some of the biggest challenges that you face because of that?
Pretty much just getting everybody to learn the music over and over again. We've had several bassists and several guitarists. Me and Dustin are the only original members of our band that we formed back in the day when we used to play punk music. Over the years, we had to change and change and change. Eventually, we came to what we're doing now, and we pretty much kept members for the most part. We've just lost bassists a lot, and that really holds back on progress.
As a bass player, it feels like someone's like, hey, you play the bass, come and be in our band. Like, I remember those days. It was it's good times. This next question is for Ryan.
What would you say is going through your head when you go up on stage? What really gets you pumped to play a show?
What really gets me pumped is the fact that I'm getting closer and closer to doing what I want to do, which is be a musician. And when I got up on stage, I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm doing it. I'm doing what I want to do. I'm doing my dream, you know.
So it's really the performance aspect that gets you going.
Oh, yeah.
So the girls, those aren't any motivators to you?
Yeah, somewhat.
Okay, good.
All right, well, Dustin, can you share with us one of your favorite moments that you've had with A Cryptic Ending?
Probably the best time I had was when we played the Knitting Factory show. And, you know, it's one of the bigger venues here in Spokane. You know, we sold, you know, pretty much 100 tickets to the show. And, there, you know, there was probably 4 other bands there that also sold about the same amount. So it was really cool to see, you know, about, you know, 400 people in there and just, you know, kind of jamming out to our music. And it was kind of cool to see the pits and everything. It was nice. Yeah, and we got paid on that show too, which was pretty all right with us.
Yeah, money's a good one. So Sean, with you being new to the band, what was it like for you the first time you played on stage in front of an audience full of fans?
It was one of the biggest rushes ever. It was, you know, just gonna throw it out there. I got a fear of heights, so I mean, when it comes to, you know, just jumping off of rocks or anything high, you know, it's just that you get yourself psyched for it. And I mean, it was really exciting getting up on there. I mean, I thought I was gonna, you know, choke, but I didn't. I just went with it. I mean, it just seemed like, you know, I'm just practicing. It's just a really big practice room, and there's a lot of people watching me, but I'm practicing. So, I mean, it's a rush getting up there, you know, and it's, you know, not knowing what to expect, you know, from reactions. And, like, I'm here to play, and I'm really thankful for, you know, getting invited to such a band. It's great.
Awesome.
Yeah, excellent. So people who are not familiar with the death metalcore style, they may not know how much work goes into creating the vocals, especially without damaging your voice. So can you describe how the process works and what you do to create such a unique sound?
Well, pretty much you want to keep your vocal cords pretty lubed up when you're screaming. Yeah, I know, lube.
So do you prefer Astroglide or do you go with the old standard and stick with the KY?
No. I'm pretty sure that would damage my throat.
Well, you know, it is glycerin based, so it can't mess you up too bad, right?
No, I go with the old you know, the olive oil and that kind of stuff. You know, sometimes honey, it helps too.
Right on.
Okay.
You have to keep your vocals like that just so the sound comes out right.
Do you do any after, you know, post-production vocal effects to your music after you recorded it to add to the unique voice sound?
Kinda. It's the guy who recorded our latest EP. He added some vocal effects, like in my yelling. He did a background glare or background layer of screams, which sounded pretty cool. He did use some effects on my voice, but it really honestly didn't need it.
Can we expect any new album to be released soon?
We're working on our album called Goodbye to a Perfect World. It should be out, hopefully, next summer is what we're planning on doing. It's just coming up with the money to do it because it's kind of expensive.
All right, thank you so much for joining us, guys. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Don't forget to check out this band's bio and where we have links for you to vote especially for them to perform at this year's Uproar Festival held at the Spokane Arena on October 2nd. Voting in soon, so don't wait. To find out even more about A Cryptic Ending and their music, as well as links to their content, including special iTunes access, visit our website, www.adphantom.com. Special thanks to all our guests, to Cody, our associate producer, and all the staff here at Ad Phantom. We once again thank you for joining us and hope you enjoyed the show. Are you in a band or have a great show idea? We love feedback, so please visit our website, www.adphantom.com, and leave a comment, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Also, don't forget to look at our daily product reviews. We will now close with a track from The Cryptic Ending, Awakening. Phantom, finding the people behind the ads.